Things about you. So thank you. Thank you for coming.
Thank you. Hi, everybody. Can I do this? There. Thank you, Billy, for asking me to come tonight. My husband being the, well, he's kind of a smart aleck. He said, before I left, he said, do you get paid for this? Mm-hmm. And I was like, yeah, actually I do. And he's like, really? I said, yeah, I get to stay sober another day. And I really mean that. I mean, I woke up this morning, I'm not going to lie, I was thinking, I don't know what I'm going to talk about, but every time I speak, I invite God in and ask him to use my words. And so throughout the day, I went to a meeting this morning, and it really struck me that I'd like to talk about emotional sobriety. And I say that because I've been sober. My sobriety date is September 24th, 2007. And so I've been without a drink for a good little bit of time, but I've had ebbs and flows of emotional sobriety. And right now, right now is another little bit of a hard one. Here we go. Daggone it. Anyway, you'll hear about that. And I think in the course of this, if you've been around the steps at all, you'll hear some of the steps interwoven into all of this. I did not know that I was such an angry / fearful person until I did an amends with my cousin, and she was my most trusted person, like in the whole world. So she said something, there was no reason for me not to believe her. And I wasn't able, I really, really wanted to make an amends face to face with her. And she lived in Oregon. And I wasn't able to do it until I was like 5 or 6 years sober. And so when it got to the part of asking her, you know, did she have some input in this? And she said, I just didn't know why you were so pissed off at the world all the time. And I'm like, what? And by now I had learned that behind anger is fear. 100% of the time. I can promise you, if you're angry about something, I will ask you enough questions until you get to the fear, because that's my experience. It's always fear. So if you would have told me, I might would have agreed that I was angry sometimes, but if you would have told me I was a real fearful person, I don't know that I would have admitted that, because I didn't know. But going back, so what it was like, what happened, what it's like now, I started to narrow my focus on just some of the anger. And my anger would always come out as justified anger, because being angry and being wrong is no fun at all. You know, I mean, had to be justified. And so I was thinking about one of the first times when I had consequences for my justified anger. And I was in the second grade. I can even remember what I was wearing. I had this little velvet jumper on with a little Peter Pan collar, my cute little shoes. And I had played during recess. To me, recess is for playing. And I got in, and of course I had to use the bathroom. I raised my hand. Mrs. Christensen said, no, you should have done that during playtime or recess. And so I got angry and I went up to her desk and peed right next to the desk, and I got in trouble. I got sent to the principal's office for that, because, you know, it's like, well, I'll show you, I have to go to the bathroom. And it wasn't, I mean, my memory of it even wasn't that I had to go so bad, but that someone was telling me no. I, to this day, quite frankly, I don't like that word very much, but anyway. And then the next year, and you have to remember, I went to school back in caveman days. So different kinds of punishment were allowed. But on recess again, I thought this little boy was really cute, and I kissed him, and he ran and told the teacher, and the teacher was bent over and, you know, doing the whole thing. And she kind of smacked my face, and I reached up and slapped her. I mean, because she was within arm's reach, and I got suspended over that one. And I couldn't understand why my mother was so upset. I just couldn't understand. And then in fourth grade or fifth grade, I got suspended again. I mean, I was getting quite the just, and it was always with this justified arguing anger. And so I believe that I was an alcoholic way before alcohol ever entered the picture, because I had the defects down pat. I mean, I just really did. And the only thing later on, which would calm those down or sometimes throw gasoline on them, was to drink. And then I would either have the courage to tell you all about yourself and why I was mad, or it would divert me enough to skip it. And so anyway, when I, oh yeah, tell me that it's closing time or I've had enough. I think you've had enough was really the worst. But anyway, so what happened? I got in the rooms because of not really consequences. I mean, I had lots of consequences, but I got into the rooms. I was babysitting, or I don't know that you babysit teenagers. I was watching a friend's teenagers while she was out of town, and actually they were great drinking buddies. And so we were all drinking and partying, and I knew I had to straighten up the day that the mom was coming home. And so I quit drinking sometime the night before. And at that point in my life, I had booze in my system all the time. And so by the time she got home, I went into a seizure and ended up in the emergency room. And there was a nurse there. I don't remember her name. I could probably find it. But there was a nurse who said to me, will you let us help you? And for whatever reason, that time I said yes. And I hadn't been to rehabs or any of that. And they said, okay, I guess. And they must have juiced me up with something. I don't remember that, but they put me in a van and went to a facility that had razor wire and locked doors. And they checked me, you know, took shoelaces and all that kind of stuff. And they did this assessment that I just knew I was being tricked. And the lady asked me if I heard voices. Now I know that's part of the deal, that they ask you different questions to see what mental state you're in. And I thought, she's trying to trick me. And so I asked her if she was talking to me. I said, are you talking to me right now? And she's like, yes. And so I said, I hear your voice, but I don't hear voices in my head. And I guess that was the right answer, because it put me in a different section of this facility, which I learned later was the behavioral science. It was the nut house. I'm just telling you, that's what it was. But I didn't know it at the time. And it scared me to death. And they dragged me out with whatever drugs they gave me. They got me off of the medicine. And they suggested strongly, there was another nurse who took my hands in her face and she said, don't you come back here. You don't belong here. And I thought to myself, that was so strange, because now I know she thought she was being kind. What I heard was, here's another place I don't belong. And so I didn't know what to do. You know, I got out and I drove around and parked outside of churches for 2 weeks and watched all of you go in the churches. And I'd say, I just can't do it. And so I did that for 2 weeks until I walked into Orange, and thus started the process of recovery. And I think the first time that I said, well, the first meeting, I did not say I was an alcoholic, but the first time crying hysterically that I said that my name is Monique and I am an alcoholic, I think was the beginning of the path to emotional sobriety. I didn't feel sober. I probably wasn't anywhere near being emotionally sober, but I can look in hindsight that just that admission, that level of honesty that I hated, I was angry at being an alcoholic. I didn't want to be one. It wasn't what I aspired to be when I grew up. And here I was admitting it to people I didn't know and didn't really want to know. And so the first step, they had all the steps up like they do here. And I saw the, you know, we were powerless. I was powerless, not we. I was powerless and didn't like that at all. You know, I mean, there was a lot of my life where I was powerless. I was in a marriage that was not healthy. And I, through doing the steps, I can see my part in it. You know, I got married to tick my parents off pretty much because they really hated this guy. But that's probably not the basis for a good marriage, but, you know, whatever. I mean, and so he certainly had his part in the demise of our marriage, but I can see my part now. And even that I was angry at. And then to be told my life was unmanageable. I'm like, no, I have the house, the job, the car, the man, sometimes the kid, you know, I mean, there were things like that, that I was justifying again, and I'd get angry all over again. Well, then when I looked at some of the consequences and the part of me that every morning would say, oh, I can't believe I did this again, or that I didn't know what I did and had to have other people fill in the blanks. That's a scary position to be in. That's pretty unmanageable. That wasn't the way that I saw my life when I was growing up. The second step, I didn't have that was my first meeting when I announced to the group that I had a God and they weren't it. And everybody smiled and nodded, keep coming back. We'll love you till you love yourself. All of these things that now I understand, I just wanted to leave and take a shower. Like, oh, get away from me. I don't want to catch it, whatever it is. It didn't feel good to me. And part of that is because I had gone so long without knowing how to be kind to myself, that when other people were kind to me, it's like, what do they want? I know they want something. And I couldn't believe the way AA worked, for one thing. You know, I mean, it's different than any, as you all know, it's different than any other organization. Third step, willingness. My sponsor, I did get a sponsor, and she was of the hard A variety, and it's exactly what I need. I think I was a little afraid of her. And actually, she was very, very kind, firm, but very kind. She never, especially, I was the most blubbering, crying woman that you ever saw that first year. And she would just, I would hear her light a cigarette. She was a heavy smoker. And I hear on the other end of the phone, light a cigarette. And she'd say, just breathe, you know, and she was patient. She'd wait until I could get it all out. But anyway, she had me on step three for the whole first year. And because I was an expert at taking my will back and arguing, that whole justified anger again, you know, just that arguing. But within that year, I was starting to get glimpses of, what do I want to say, accepting the kindness, you know, that people were being genuine and authentic and really just seemed to want the best for each other. And I started to trust, and Lori, I call her name now, she's passed away, but I would feed her little pieces of me and wait to hear if it got all over town, as if I was that important. But I'm just telling you, that's the way I was operating. And it wasn't. And she probably honestly didn't remember, like by next Tuesday, what I had said the week before, but it just, I had not had much experience with trust. And so to trust another human being and the sponsor-sponsee relationship I have found is very unique anyway. For one thing, it's probably, or at least in my life, the first sober relationship I ever had. And that includes my current husband, because I met him as a drinking buddy. He's not one of us by any stretch, but I can't think of another sober relationship. And so to have a relationship where you say what you mean and you mean what you say, because somebody's going to call you on your BS. It's like, well, isn't that refreshing? And it actually really is, but it's different than any other relationship. So I had to trust her because she was sober and I wasn't. And I still was nowhere near any kind of emotional sobriety. I had quit crying, but I was on the roller coaster of now taking care of my husband who had had a stroke, who was not yet my husband, who had had a stroke, and wondering, being angry about it because I was fearful. He's the one that had the stroke and I'm sitting in my house going, what's going to happen to me? I'm not married. I have given a good portion at that point, maybe 14 years of my life to his business. And now I'm supposed to do what? And I mean, I really remember thinking that. And that also was at the same night that I realized that I had a spiritual experience, because I was in our house. There is bourbon. I know exactly where it is. That's what he drinks. I was by myself having all of these very fearful thoughts and being ticked off at myself too, you know, as I'm thinking this through, and a drink never occurred to me. How does that happen? I mean, I was 46, 47 years old and had drank most of that time. And here I am with the perfect excuse and opportunity, and it was gone. And that increased my trust in God, because I wasn't falling on my knees that night asking. I was in complete fear mode. And so at the end of that year, it was time for the good old fourth step. And that's where I really realized how angry I was, because there were a lot of people who did me wrong and they were on that resentment list. And when it got to what was my part, that was hard because I didn't want a part in any of this. And well, I mean, once in a while, but you know, and so I thought I had, it occurred to me this morning when I was writing my grant list, my whole life, I wanted to be perfect. And I'm not sure where that came from, because I don't recall anyone ever asking me to be perfect. Like, I don't remember my parents saying, you better be perfect or. And what a setup for failure, because whose idea of perfect is it? And so anyway, I'm just grateful that today I know I'm perfectly imperfect, and it's just, I am who I am. But when I wrote this fourth step, I did it perfectly and had my columns and everything just so. And I took it and she looked at it and she said, well, or I started, I guess, talking. And she said, well, you have some more writing to do. So she ended up on my resentment list, and I did some more writing. And when it was time to actually do the fifth step with her, I expected the heavens to open and the angels to sing. I mean, I just thought everything would be better. And things were better. In hindsight, things were definitely better. I mean, I wasn't having blackouts and consequences and things, but What I realized was it was the first time in my life I wasn't looking over my shoulder, and that there was one other person on this earth that knew all of my stuff. I mean, there were things that I had held back from my priest because, I mean, what's he going to think about me? But she knew it all, and she didn't fall over dead. She did smoke a lot of cigarettes that day, and her little cavalier I petted to death. But anyway, and so that was a very freeing experience. But there were a lot of other things that didn't get better. And I like to tell newcomers, I know it's not a popular thing, but I tell them that first year is a booger. I mean, it's not easy, and things don't, they will get better, but they don't always feel better. And I was a year sober, and if I offend anybody, it's par for the course. I don't mean to, I promise you. It's just, I have to talk from my soul. My first year, I went to the doctor, and I had calculated how many calories were in alcohol, and I drank a lot. And it hadn't really occurred to me that now I wasn't throwing up, I was eating. So I get to the doctor, and nothing was better. My weight was actually higher. And well, my triglycerides, I guess, were better. But my numbers, my cholesterol, everything was off the roof, off the charts, I mean. And so this doctor, she was very nice. She said, well, you know, we need to talk about your diet. And I stood there with my fists at my side. And the poor thing, I'm sure my voice was not calm. And I said, I have quit drinking. I'm barely having sex. I don't smoke. You are not taking away my food. And she was, I mean, her poor little eyes were like, okay, chill, you know, relax. And I mean, I was so angry that day, not really with her, but that here I am a year sober, darn it. And why isn't everything better? And of course, I called my sponsor on the way back from Charlottesville, and she's like, oh, it'll even out. Everything will be fine. And over time, you know, things have. I was probably about 25, 28 pounds heavier than I am now. I assure you, I did nothing to lose it other than quit drinking. Things just even out. And that's what I try and tell the newer person is just time takes time. And I hated that phrase too, but it really does, just in everything. So anyway, moving on, 6 and 7. I live in 6 and 7 now because my defects, particularly if I am pushed into a corner or I feel like I'm being pushed into a corner, they will rise quickly. And I shared at my home group, I'm trying to think how general I can do this. I shared at my home group recently that, oh, heck, I'm just going to throw it out there. So 29 years ago, I was the other woman. And I'm not proud of that. That's a fact of how things were. And I can honestly say I would make different choices now. But anyway, that's what it was. And about 3 months, 2 months ago, maybe, I was in a coffee shop. And I actually heard some people from our town talking about it. I mean, like, my name is not that normal. It's not like Jane, you know, and my husband's name is not that. And it was all I could do not to let every defect of character roll. I mean, really, I wanted to turn around and say, I've been sober 14 years and we got married and everything worked out for the best. And all of these things because of that justified anger and the fear that people were, what they thought of me. Well, obviously, if they're still talking about it 29 years later, I can know what they think about it. But anyway, and there was so much attached to that. And I think the only thing that saved me, the God shot, God is in the pause, by the way. The only thing that saved me is I was sitting with a sponsee, a longtime sponsee of mine. And maybe that, what would she think of me, saved me from getting, because man, when I feel in a corner, those defects just bubble right up and I have about this much emotional sobriety. So on any given day, my defects, I've had one removed, like completely removed. And the only reason I know that is because I have tried to pull it up and use it and it won't surface. And so I do believe that one's been removed. The others, I feel like they've been dampened or tampered down, but man, that showed me that maybe I was getting a little too confident in that. Moving on to eight, the amends process. So one of my favorite stories I like to tell, and those of you who've been in meetings with me have heard it, but it's still, I need to keep it fresh in my own mind, about following sponsor's direction. She told me early on, I wanted the monkey off my back. I think there's some of you could relate to that. You know, if I just go say, I'm sorry, it'll all be better. It's like, you don't even understand what amends are. You're on step three. Stop. And it's like, yeah, okay. And a man who is my husband's friend, who I do not care for, I had caused him some harm and I needed to make an amends at some point, not, you know, but anyway, I was a year sober and he was in our kitchen. My husband wasn't home yet. And I thought, oh, see, here it is, the perfect opportunity. And so I start apologizing and he let me get through it. And then he looked at me and he's, and we're in a church, so I won't say it, but he said, F you, and walked out of my house. I thought, well, that didn't go like I planned. And so later that day he came in and he said, I carried my 24-hour chip and my 1-year medallion in my pocket for like 5 years. And I never knew he had been in the program. He's not now, but I never knew that. And he said to me, when you understand amends, maybe we'll have a talk. And I was 3 years sober. And we had a little barbecue thing at the house, not for my sobriety, but for just barbecue. And he apparently had kept up with around the time I got sober. And he came in and he reached out his hand to shake my hand. And he had his 3-year medallion, at which he gave to me. And we've never talked since. That was the amends. Like, that was him accepting that I had changed and it was done. And so most of my other amends were very, very good. You know, people genuinely just seemed almost relieved that I was in society as a sober woman versus the whirling dervish that I tended to be most of the time. And so that's the ninth. I'm sorry. The eighth was the list. And the list was, I'm going to backtrack just a little bit. The list was very valuable because that there again, I went through it with a sponsor and she crossed things off because she explained to me, I was trying to alleviate my discomfort and my guilty feelings of events. And it would serve no purpose. And it just wouldn't serve a purpose. And so that was a valuable lesson for me because I was willing to say I was sorry, but I wasn't necessarily willing to amend my behavior in certain instances either. And that's the goal, you know, to amend, to be the woman that I believe God wants me to be today. The 10th step has absolutely saved my marriage. Because that poor guy, he gets the brunt of it, you know, and I often think sometimes we're sharpest with the ones that we love, maybe because they're safe. I don't know. But I do know that Immediate for me, most of the time is immediate, like what the dictionary says, but sometimes it's like I have to leave the room, calm down, and then come back and say something, because I think I just enjoy that whole being right. Yeah, I'm pretty sure I do. Because I still like, I mean, I tease sometimes with one of my sponsees that when Lori would say, do you want to be happy or do you want to be right? And I'm like, I am happy when I'm right. And so she recognizes that in me. 11 today is very, very important to me. I spend a lot of time in prayer and meditation. In the morning, I concentrate on freeing up my mind, and whatever consistently floats through, if I can grab a word, I concentrate on that word because I feel like that's what my purpose is that day. And today was connection. The word connection kept coming up. I mean, I was thinking about my son, and I was thinking about how our stories connect us. I was thinking about different family events, neighbors. I was just thinking of all these different connections, and I thought, maybe that's something for me to focus on today. And so when I still attend a Zoom meeting, or two Zoom meetings actually, and these people, I've come to love them. I was with them every Sunday during COVID, and I was looking at each square and thinking how I was connected to each of those people, because other than a couple of them who we've done things outside of AA, I don't really know them, and yet I know them. And so that was a beautiful thing for me. And so 11, asking God to help me be the woman I'm supposed to be, or that I'm supposed to be. One reason I do that is I still am finding out who I am, and it's evolving. I mean, today I'm a grandma, and I'm a sober grandma, and none of my grands have seen me drink. They know I don't drink, but they haven't. It's not a big focus. They're small still. Well, I don't know. The oldest one, she's a preteen going on 20, and she's starting to ask some questions, but I've always said I want to be honest and authentic with them. My son is, he drinks the way I drink, and he contributes. This is going to come out funny, but not funny. He contributes to my unemotion, not being emotionally sober. Completely fear-based, because, you know, I'm his mom, and I'm watching this train going down the track that's going to derail at some point. And it's had some little snafus with arrests and losing licenses and these beautiful children that he's not present for. And I get so mad. And even this morning, I said, I am so blooming mad at my son. And I'm really not. I'm angry at alcoholism. And I am angry also that I know there is a solution, but he's not ready. And at 38, I was nowhere near being close to being ready. Nowhere near. So sometimes knowing that the same God that's watching over me is watching over him and everyone else that our moments of silence land on is not comforting. And at other times it brings me peace. And so then the step 12 for me, I mean, I actually like to sponsor women. I find it to be inconvenient and frustrating and rewarding. It's like all of the things mixed into one. Like when I see the light go off in their eyes, that's wonderful. That's the payoff for me. And not because I have anything to do other than be a channel. But if I can ever make another person, and men or women. I mean, I got sober with a lot of old men in this fellowship, and I will not discount 50% of the population who might save my life. So I bring that up because I never tell my sponsees what to do anyway, but I never tell them not to go to women's meetings. I personally am not a fan of them because I want to hear the solution, and I capitalize the word solution. I want to hear solution from whomever it comes from. And I've heard it in some very unlikely places. But anyway, I don't know where that was going. Oh, well. So 12 stepping, I have gone on 12 steps. Those are heartbreaking to me. I remember going on one and the woman was strapped down in the hospital and I knew her. She relapsed a lot. And I said to her, "You know, this is going to kill you." And I now know that I won't say that again, because she said, "I hope so." And that was hard. That was hard to hear, because, but looking back, you couldn't have scared me sober either. You couldn't have scared me sober. I wanted to drink. It was a temporary relief, but it was a relief. Oh, I know what I was going to say about either speaking, sponsoring, what have you. I felt alone for so much of my life. Like, I was different. And perhaps, you know, perhaps I was in some ways, maybe I wasn't. It doesn't matter. That it's such a lonely feeling to not be able to just tell somebody that this is scary, or I hate being married to this guy. I remember, you know, he had a lot of good qualities. I remember being afraid to tell anybody that I didn't like this guy. I just didn't like him. I made a mistake. I couldn't tell anybody that. I don't think I uttered those words until I got sober. And so part of speaking and part of talking one-on-one to women is to let people know that they're not alone. Because I think that's the beginning of the emotional sobriety. Because emotional sobriety for me means being comfortable in my skin. I didn't get sober to be uncomfortable. I just didn't. If I'm going to be uncomfortable, I'm going to at least have a little bit of fun doing it. So I don't want to be consistently uncomfortable. I want to know how to get out of the discomfort, because life happens and there's things that just are not fun. And so I come to the connection of the group. You guys are my strength, if you will. And nobody has to have the exact same experience as me. But the head nods when I say, "This stinks." You know, having a son that drinks, who might die, it stinks. That is just precious to me. And I'm going to share a story I also shared on Saturday, because it means a lot. I went to the beach recently. I go back and forth a lot. And there's meetings I go to down there. And there was one of my regular meetings, and there was a young man there. Well, young to me, young man there. And he wasn't one of us. And he finally spoke, and that's how I knew he wasn't one of us. And he said that his mom had died a couple of years before, and that he was visiting from California. He still had her house. And that he was starting to lose the sense of his mom. Like, he couldn't feel her when he was in her house and around her things. And so he came to the AA meeting, and he said that sitting there, he could feel his mom. What is wrong with me? Anyway, that really touched me, because I thought, you know, if we keep showing up, we get to be each other's strength, you know? So anyway, that's it.